Before Shopify, were you wondering, where are my sales at? Now you're selling with Shopify, the global commerce platform supercharging your selling. You have no problem selling online, in person, on social media, and beyond. Gary, easy on the cha-ching.
Oh, sorry, but my Shopify sales are through the roof.
Start selling with Shopify today and discover how millions of businesses around the world use Shopify to ignite their selling. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/listen. Shopify.com/listen.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
It's sunny.
It is. It's chilly, but it's sunny.
Yeah, but it's actually, spring is coming, or has come, and I'm really happy about it.
Why are you happy?
Because yesterday I went walking very close to where I live on Hampstead Heath.
Oh my God.
And I was thinking about the weight of the world and all of the...
The weight of the world?
Yeah, I've been reading the news and I was a bit like, ugh, you know, everything.
All the worries of the world, actually, how much the world actually
weighs.
Yeah,
they were like, my shoulders.
God.
And then I stopped in my tracks because I saw a worm on the concrete and he was like energetically kind of writhing around on the path in
How
front
you know
of
it was
me.
A he?
Well, he looked like a he. And
a he worm.
Anyway, a he worm. Okay, they.
Oh, yeah, good.
Anyway, yeah.
The fluid worm.
Okay, yeah. Can we move on from this? Anyway, and then I suddenly stopped and was like, almost expecting this worm to shout at me and say, eat me, or like a voice from the skies echoing loudly, eat the worm.
With the weight of the world.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because that is a theme that I have seen in the work of the artist we are meeting today.
Yes, totally.
And the point is that his work has made me look at the world in a different way, and I now notice worms on concrete paths.
And they're talking to you.
They're talking to me.
Wow.
I think maybe
that
I need
is
to
quite, that is quite
check
an incredible
into a
achievement.
Clinic somewhere to get a bit of
yeah.
mental health.
Yes.
But anyway, our guest today is a conceptual artist.
Mm-hmm.
He makes work in all mediums, everything from like drawing, animation, neon, even like Limoges salt and pepper shakers, which I bought as a gift for...
Not me. I didn't get
well,
them.
Which I won't say who I gave them to, but a very famous person. Music, photography, bronze sculpture, painting, editions, multiples. There's a whole universe of merchandise, everything from like posters, postcards, mugs, pin badges, coasters for your tea and
or coffee,
or even water.
Yeah, you can put water on a coaster.
Or champagne, if you like a bit of champagne, or English sparkling wine, mm-hmm. who knows. Even inflatable swimming pool floats,
yes,
which look like giant
Who
swans.
Is it, Rob?
It's David Shrigley.
Hi, David.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Do people call you Shriggers for short?
They call me all sorts of things. I'm not. It should be noted that I am not the only Shrigley in the world. I'm not the only.
Oh, you're not
Shriggers.
Really?
The only. Shrig.
What about the Shrig?
There's a
the Shrig Shrag.
Well, there's a family of Shrigs that I'm related to, and there are other Shrigs in other countries.
What other countries?
America, for one.
Wow!
Yes.
You're so global.
You made it all the way over there.
Well, I didn't, but my, you know, ancestors
yes.
have travelled.
Where is Shrigley from, the name?
Shrigley apparently is from the north of England. There's a place in Cheshire called Pot Shrigley, and there's a stately home called Shrigley Hall.
No.
Which is now a sort of conference venue.
Wow.
And that could that be part of your family lineage, that hall?
It could be, because...
You could lay claim on that.
I could do. I think I'd still have to pay were I to have a weekend there.
Is it like a National Trust property?
No, it's owned by some large multinational corporation who own those
Fantastic.
Kind of things.
Yeah, I love them.
Yeah. Damn, I was going to say maybe there was like a collaboration possibility for you to like
stop,
do a sculpture park.
Anyway.
Moving on.
Going back to Cheshire, I was actually born in Macclesfield, although I'm not from there. My parents aren't from there. They lived there for a couple of years in the late 1960s and I was born. And then they left and I grew up in Leicester and my parents are from the southeast. And now I live in Brighton.
Oh, so you're based in Brighton now?
I'm based in Brighton, but I spent most of my adult life in Glasgow in Scotland.
Yes, you did. Studying, because you went to the Glasgow School of Art.
Aye.
Fantastic. And how was that?
All right.
All right. I saw a video where, and I think it's about 16 years ago, where they were doing a tour, a bus tour, around Glasgow, and they were going to various spots where you had laid work down in a public arena.
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen this video?
Yeah, it was.
But they never know. You were very elusive, and it was like, "Who is David Trigley?"
Yeah. Well, it was sort of awkward looking back because I think this would have been in the early 2000s, and I decided at that point. I think it's because I had become acquainted with Banksy,
right?
And Banksy
was,
as you know, is
mysterious,
is pathologically absent from public life, kind of thing. And I thought, that's good. That's a handy way, because then you don't ever have to do any interviews or anything like that. And I thought, I'll do that. So this woman, who was really nice, she said, I really want to make this TV program. And I said, yeah, but I'm going to be elusive from now on.
I've just decided. Yeah.
And she's like, oh, please. Yeah. And I said, well, all right, as long as I don't have to be in it. So they had to weave that into the narrative, which was this mysterious person, elusive character, Shrigley.
Yes.
So,
how long did you keep that up for?
Well, unfortunately for them, I've kept it up for about less than a year.
And then they were like, oh, that's him. And he's really like, hello.
A year later, I was on a culture show and it was a bit like, of nonsense.
That's annoying.
For them, yeah. Sort of hilarious.
Did you know Banksy or do you know Banksy?
I might do.
Amazing.
I might do.
Very good.
Not allowed to say.
So talking of Banksy, that's actually where I first ever saw your work, because I was doing PR when I was a young musician trying to survive and live and everything. And I used to do PR for lots of different creative things. And one of the things we promoted was Banksy for a bit. And you had a print on picturesonwalls.com, which was a kind of street art website at the time for Banksy and Fail and all these big artists. And it was an amazing handwritten letter to Bananarama. From a fan, wasn't it? Fan perspective.
Yeah. Well, we had a conversation. All right, I do know Banksy, okay. He is a real person. But he and I had a conversation about whether the print should be signed, because his whole Pictures on Walls things was that, you put this limited edition print out there and it cost, I don't know, £30 or something, so that it was in some way democratizing or making accessible fine art products.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, but it still costs £30. So if it's... You know, if it's democratizing it, why does it need to have a signature on it? Mm. And he was like, yeah, but you have to sign it, otherwise people won't want it. And I said, I don't want to sign it, so I didn't sign it.
And wasn't it an unlimited edition, that one?
It wasn't. It was a really huge edition, like 750.
Okay.
I mean, this is quite pertinent for you and I, we should say.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you two have worked together.
We've worked together a number of times now. And actually, we're continuing to work together this year, which is really exciting. But for countereditions.com, and we've made numerous prints with you. The first one you did was actually a hand-drawn edition where you drew every single one. And then we've made...
That's the one, This Will Not Be Here Tomorrow, the sign.
Yes.
In the grass on the stake.
Yeah.
What was unique about each of them? Did you hand write the text each time?
I drew them all individually.
Oh, I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, they were complete unique drawings.
What was the edition size of that?
100.
What was that? I mean, that's quite an arduous, laborious thing. Then after a while, you must go a bit crazy doing the same repetitive image or...
Repetitive strain. It's good to have a task that you don't have to think about too hard.
Yeah.
Because almost all of my tasks, including this one, I have to think about them.
Mm.
And I have to think of things, say... To do.
Have you been thinking about this interview?
Yes.
What did you think before you came to the interview?
Well, I had preconceptions about it.
Oh, what were those?
The first preconception was I wasn't expecting the recording studio to be so boutique.
Oh yeah, no, we are boutique.
The word.
We're very bougie. Me and
we're
Rob.
So bougie.
Oh yeah,
it's bourgeois and boutique and hipster.
Thank you.
Should I say, because we are.
She is a bit hipster. You're right.
No, but that was our decision because we could have bought a load of recording gear and sat around my kitchen table and brought people in. But it feels like we're going to work in a kind of like really lovely way, in a cathartic way. You come here and you invite the guests and yes, and they get the reaction. I think you get a better response when you feel like it's more legit.
Yeah, it's also in the King's Cross area, isn't it?
Yeah, well, this whole area is actually like a new city. It's kind of like sort of landed in London. Like, it feels quite sci-fi. All these flat blocks and offices and restaurants and
it's conversions.
Just, it all just suddenly appeared out of nowhere almost. It's crazy.
I don't know how comfortable I feel in this environment. I mean, I like being with you.
Thank you.
But this area of King's Cross, it's sort of it's still finding its identity, isn't it?
True. Yeah, totally, yeah. Yeah, it's quite an odd place. So going back to printmaking,
what
question I wanted to ask you was, do you like the idea that your work generally is kind of an accessible thing? Because we found out from a number of our friends that they got into contemporary art through your work.
Yeah.
So you were the first artist where they felt it was open enough and they could relate to it somehow. Mm. And then that piqued their interest and now they're actually fascinated in it.
Yeah.
And talking about your parents, I know that your parents actually had the same experience where they had very little understanding of contemporary art or the art world. And then through your success, they've now become interested in it too. And I kind of liked that idea that...
The access point. You're a good access point.
Yeah.
I'm a conduit.
You are a conduit. Yes. The conduit, Wrigley.
The conduit.
Yeah.
You're like a Pied Piper.
If I was a wrestler,
you'd be the conduit.
Yeah, my ring name would be the
That's
conduit.
Hot. That is hot. That's a hot name.
Covered in tomatoes or something. Wrestling.
How do you feel about that then? The fact that people are discovering contemporary art through your work and continuing to love your work as well, obviously.
Well, there are two answers, I suppose. One is true and one is just the thing that you'd want to hear. The answer that you want to hear is, yeah, that's great. You know, I love it. But in reality is, as an artist, you never intend to do anything. I've never intended to do anything and I've just become the artist that I am because that's just the way it turned out. And I'm very happy that, you know, I am the conduit for some people. But It really isn't by design at all. So I can't... It's only on occasions like this that I'm invited to think about it. Yeah. And also, I'm really aware that all the dialogue that I have about my own work, it only exists when I'm being interviewed, which is why when you look back to other interviews, I completely contradict myself in sort of cycles of about 5 years. So 5 years ago, I'd probably given you completely different answers. Maybe you'd have asked different questions.
Well, everyone changes, don't they? But are you aware of them differences when you're actually suddenly answering the question that you've been asked 5 years previously?
I look upon occasions like this just to get out of the studio. It's just nice to have a bit of company, have some nice coffee, see a different part of town.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Stroke your beautiful dog.
Yes, you know. He is beautiful, isn't he? And you've got a dog.
I do have a
dog. What's your dog's name?
My dog's name is Inca, and she is a six-year-old miniature schnauzer, black in colour, going grey.
And she's in Brighton at the moment?
She's in Devon, actually, with my wife. We have a house in Devon paid for by Count Tradition.
That's actually true, right?
And also, your dog also exists in a parallel universe on your iPhone screen.
Yes, and you do drawings of dogs. You were saying earlier on that we had a chat before we came in that you've mastered the ability of drawing dogs through your own dog.
I wouldn't say I've mastered it, but I have improved significantly.
Do you have a London base? You've got a studio here?
No, I live in Brighton. That's only a stone's throw away.
That's
easy, isn't it?
You're fine.
Yeah.
And is your studio like in your house there, or is it a separate venture?
Well, I used to have a really great studio when I lived in Glasgow, and then we decided to move about 4 years ago, and now I have a very various studio arrangement where I the basement of our house is a separate apartment and I work in there, but it's a bit pokey. And then my assistant, I rent the flat next door, and my assistant works in there, and we have the archive
parentheses
and then I rent a space at the end of the street.
Hang on a minute, no, let's go back on that parentheses. Why archive parentheses? Is there just nothing in the archive because it's all gone, or what?
some of the things in the archive aren't normally things that one would assume you'd have to archive, kind of thing.
Like?
Bits of wood and things like that.
And these are things you found on the beach, or...?
Things I just can't get, haven't got around to throwing away.
So sentimental value, archiving?
No, it's more like obsessive compulsive storage.
Really?
Yeah.
So you're a hoarder, basically?
I'm in a very irrational kind of way, yeah. The archive...
Parenthesis.
It's not...
conduit parenthesis, that's what we're going to call
it. Speech mark, this is parenthesis.
Oh, yeah.
There's one finger on it. Anyway, I digress. So, yeah, I have a bit of a scatological attitude towards the things I keep and the things I discard.
But do you think they're going to appear in work?
I was about to say, are they things that you're keeping because they're like ideas or they generate ideas? Is that why you hold on to them? Or is it just...
Because I think they're going to be useful because I think I could throw that away, but as soon as I throw it away, I'm going to need it.
You're going to be like, shit, I wish I had that bit of wood.
I wish I had that bit of wood. That would have been perfect for opening this... opening this...
Conceptual skull. Door. Yeah.
So going back to the studios... I've got another studio at the end of the road that I rent from the church, which is really great, actually, and really inexpensive and cool. It's great. We should be there in a way, but it might be noisy, and you know what Brighton's like.
Yeah, especially the church.
I love Brighton. I used to spend a lot of time there when I was younger.
Yeah. Yeah.
I particularly like it in the winter when it's like really stormy, and I used to be a bit mental and walk in the storms along the seafront because I loved it so much.
Did you see any worms?
I didn't see any worms.
Worms blowing up into your face.
I love the drama of it.
The drama of Brighton.
Drama of like
life.
Stormy weather.
Wow, you're amazing.
Oh my God.
But why did you leave Glasgow? And if you were so happy, was that just like a family thing?
I don't know. I don't have any kids. My wife and I don't have any kids, and we have a dog. So if you asked her, it'd probably be a different story. Mm. But my version of the story is that we got the dog, and then we thought, well, we're not going to go on holiday to Tenerife anymore in the wintertime because we can't take the dog on EasyJet.
No, they don't allow them.
No. So we thought, well, we'll have to holiday within the UK. So we looked around the Trossachs and Argyll and Bute for a holiday location. Mm-hmm. Mm. And anyway, we paid off our mortgage by this point with the help of counter-additional. So we tried to buy this holiday home, a holiday cottage. And they're really expensive in Argyll and Bute. And then we thought, and there's loads of midges and it rains all the time.
Yeah.
So we were watching the programme with Hugh Fearnley-Whittingstall, the TV chef, and who's down in Dorset, Devon, Dorset. And we were like, where's that? We want some of that lifestyle action. And so we looked it up, and it's like right down at the bottom. And it turns out it's right near the bottom of the M5. So you can go straight down from Glasgow and be there in 7 hours.
Oh, just a basic 7 hours.
Just a basic 7 hours.
Yeah, that's a quick trip, isn't it? That's lovely.
Off a skip and a jump.
Yeah.
If you were in America,
for a weekend. Yeah, that's what they do.
Yeah.
Just for like a Saturday night party, yeah.
In reality, on our island, that's most of the island.
That is, yes, top to bottom.
So anyway, it was relatively easy to get there. And we bought this little house in East Devon, and it was great. And then when we got down there, the weather was really nice. We're like, oh, it's really warm down here. It's like being in the south of France. So we thought... I don't want to go back to Glasgow because it rains all the time.
Mm. So, and the midges.
And the midges. So that was that, really. And then we sold our apartment in Glasgow. And we thought, well, we can't really live in Devon all the time because you can't get to the airport and it's quite hard to get to London and whatnot. So Brighton, you know.
And how long is the drive from Brighton to Devon?
3.5 hours.
Okay, it's a bit less.
In a half.
Okay, so moving on from travel tips. going back to accessibility, one of the things I find really funny in the phenomenon of David Shrigley is that on your website you actually have a section for tattoos, and it seems like people all over the world have taken
imagery of your...
Yeah, taking your work and then put it on their bodies.
Well, I guess because it's line drawings, a lot of your work, isn't it? So it's quite an easy adaptation.
How the hell do you feel about that? Yeah. It makes me feel quite weird. Like, that. I think I'd feel some sort
Has
of
Has anyone got a tattoo of you, Rob?
I don't know, maybe after this podcast they will.
tattoo of you?
Yeah.
Well, I was in a band once. I had some fans, and maybe they've tattooed my face on their body. I'm sure Russell's all over people's bodies.
Big time. I'm on everyone. Well, I feel weird about it, is the short answer.
It's really quite weird, though, isn't it?
But, you know, it's one of these things that I've ended up doing, and it's sort of too late to set a precedent for not doing it, if you know what I mean.
Mm.
So I just sort of done it in an ambivalent way, and then it just sort of happened.
So do you actually, like, design them for people?
I used to, yeah, but now I've tried to just, there's a buffer between me and the outside world now, my assistant who answers the emails.
Oh, I see. So that makes it easier to decline.
She occasionally will come into my room and have a pad and a pencil and say, this young woman wants a tattoo of a banana. Can you just draw a banana? So I'll draw the banana and the deal is done. I don't have to talk to her.
But would you see the finished product on her body somewhere?
Well, I think it just appears on the website by magic. Like the person will send the
amazing
photograph of the tattoo to my assistant and then my assistant puts it on the website, and I'm sort of I'm none the wiser.
And what if someone wanted to buy the picture of that banana? Then could the person who has the tattoo on their body acquire that?
Well, I have a policy that money shouldn't change hands, because that means that I have less responsibility somehow.
Okay.
Yeah, fair enough.
But would you send them the drawing?
Nah,
you keep that. You archive that with the wood.
I archive it with the wood. Yeah. In the box with the wood.
Right. So there's something that you've done recently was with Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London, which was when they had that whole hashtag campaign, London is open. Mm. And then you did some drawings for billboard tubes and
you did
all things like that. Oh. How did that all come about? And do you see that as like a part of your work that's kind of more political somehow?
Or public?
Again, I, you know, there are two answers. One is, yeah, I love to engage with the political liberal politics and progressive politics in particular. And I just really wanted to be part of that campaign.
Well, no, but I'm only asking because of Brexit and because of everything that's been happening in the UK. And there was a time when people felt like maybe the UK was going to close the doors or whatever. You know what I mean? And then I felt
your
drawing that was on all the billboards was actually this really hopeful
message,
and it was political somehow, even if you didn't mean it to be. It kind of ended up becoming that.
Yes, you're right. But the honest answer is yes. Obviously, I agree with that campaign broadly speaking. Mm. But the reality was, it's just they asked me, and the woman who is the deputy culture minister, she's really nice, Justine Simons, and I was like, yeah, no, I'll do it, and I just did it one day. And I thought, well, I better say yes, because the fourth plinth thing's coming up. So,
oh, of course, it coincided with that.
And it was fine, and it was great and everything. But for me, it was just a means to an end. It was a way to just help with somebody's project that I approved of.
Yeah.
So I don't know how political, you know, to what extent was it a political intervention on my part? It was just an illustration.
Yeah.
Basically. It was just a bit of illustration. I don't do a lot of illustration these days, but yeah.
Do you find it tough, people projecting onto your work so much? Or do you feel like that's exactly what your work is meant to do?
I think it's, yeah, exactly what the work's meant to do. I think the work is whatever you think it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as a conceptual artist, Robert called me a conceptual artist.
Would you call yourself a conceptual artist?
I do, and I have, but now you mention it, I'm not quite sure what I mean by that. Like, in that way that I just revise things that I've said and completely contradict myself.
Well, conceptual in the fact that you allow the public to... that your work is activated by a public's view of it.
Yeah.
Some art just is its own thing, but your work is so interactive.
And we were talking earlier about, we've interviewed Ryan Gander and Martin Creed, and there is some...
And they're officially conceptual artists.
Both of whom are fully certified conceptual artists, whereas my relationship to conceptual art is slightly more tenuous.
Okay.
Yes.
Because on account of the fact that a lot of people just see me as a graphic artist, kind of cartoonist.
And how do you feel about that?
I don't really mind. I'm quite happy.
Uh-huh.
I think the thing about sitting between two areas or two disciplines or two idioms or whatever you want to call it, is or a number of disciplines, is that you get to do lots of different things, so you don't get bored. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I were, if I was like a figurative painter, mm-hmm. for example, if I were like, I don't know, name me a figurative painter. Tal R, who's a friend of mine, you know, Danish.
Love Tal R.
He's brilliant, totally brilliant. And not a million miles away from what I do, kind of thing, graphically. But he's very much a painter and a graphic artist. And if I were that good at doing what he does, because he's brilliant, he's a brilliant painter, he's a just a brilliant, uses colour in a fantastic way. And I use colour in a very, very primitive way, which is, and the way I justify that is to say that I'm a conceptual artist. It's basically saying, no, I don't need to exercise any craft skill because I'm a conceptual artist, mm-hmm. even though I don't have any craft skills to demonstrate.
I don't agree with that.
But... Well, anyway, that's aside. What was the point I was making? So the thing is, unlike Talar, I'm allowed to... the work can go in lots of different places. It can kind of go on T-shirts a bit more easily than his work can, for example. And I can, you know, be in a rock band and it be seen as not so far away from the idiom which I work in. Like somehow it sort of fits in a way that it doesn't necessarily fit for a figurative painter and sculptor.
Right.
So the fact that my work is as it is, it's just sort of...
Accessible
graphic, but it's kind of like graphics without demonstrating a lot of craft skill. And it's kind of has an everyman quality to it in that
totally.
The craft skills that are demonstrated are quite attainable by most people.
But I do feel that with your work, you know, if I did a doodle on a piece of paper, it's going to look rubbish. Whereas your you know...
Well, your line, we recognise your line.
Your line is so iconic and so...
And even though it's so simple, your font and your line is people know what it is.
But even the composition on the paper, like, everything. Like,
you say that. Yeah. But, for example, if Russell were to write a letter to you...
Well, he has Robert, done. We actually spoke about it yesterday.
You would see the envelope and you would be, oh, it's a letter from Russell. Because you know, because his handwriting is so familiar to you, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that's just an extension of the same thing. It's just that, you know, everybody sees my handwriting, and then people are really surprised that my handwriting is on the postcard that I send them from East Devon, kind of thing. And they're like, "Ooh, it's your handwriting."
It's, it's not conceptual handwriting.
No, it's not.
It's official.
It is my handwriting.
Yeah.
So. It just, and that, you know, obviously I do it all the time and that's how I make a living. But nonetheless, it's still just that, you know, 25 years ago, it wasn't recognisable. And, you know.
To your loved ones and your friends, it was.
Yeah, to some extent, yeah.
So who is your inspiration? Because I was talking to someone the other day and they were like, is he like the modern Keith Haring? And I said, well, Keith Haring had a political agenda and it was of a different time. But do you feel like that... Because his work was, he like played with the same narrative, the same characters appeared all the time. Do you feel like he's a big inspiration to you?
Not necessarily Keith Haring as such. I mean, I think he's really interesting to look back upon in the sense because his work is sort of like started out like Banksy's and mm-hmm. Jean-Michel Basquiat in that he was a street artist mm-hmm. who crossed over to being a fine artist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then his work changed, and that was, you know, albeit tragically short career, it's a really interesting one to look back upon. But in terms of the artists that I'm influenced by, that I really admire, they are kind of boring in a way, like Marcel Duchamp and Andy Warhol.
Not boring. Well, Andy Warhol is completely, with all your products you create, this getting your vision out there on very accessible things for everybody to live with every day, arts for everyone. That's what you, I guess that's been a big inspiration then.
Well, I think from the moment that I realised what contemporary art was or what modern art was, I guess Dada was the touchstone for me.
I was going to say that.
When I first, you know, when I was 14 or 15, buying the Thames and Hudson Guide to Art.
Yeah.
The Dadaism version.
And you can definitely see that in your work. And that's also why I was kind of asking about political things, because I wasn't, because they were responding so much to World War One. And
yeah, I mean, that attitude towards making something that was completely other and was completely anarchic, but it sort of changed the world, but it sort of changed art, but it sort of changed nothing. Mm. And it was, you know, I guess I only think back to it now and again, but I was in, I think it was, 20, was it 2016 was the anniversary of Dada.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's just say what Dada is.
Anyway.
For people that are listening that wouldn't know what Dada is.
Dada was an art movement that occurred roughly around the time of the First World War, 1916 maybe. Mm. And there were two simultaneous movements in Zurich and in Paris. And a strand in New York as well. I can't really remember. But anyway, it was basically a movement that was in opposition to a lot of political things that were happening at the time, very much in opposition to the changes that the First World War brought about worldwide. So it was art and anti-art. Mm-hmm. It was just an art movement that was based on rebellion against everything. So Marcel, the iconic work of Dada is Marcel Duchamp's urinal, where he presented a urinal in an art gallery, which seems kind of passé now, but at the time,
shocking
was kind of shocking. But it's difficult to know, you know, these works kind of ossify and have a different meaning over time. But but reading about the Dadaists, and you know, it's a large group of artists and things that they did, was really inspirational to me when I was 14 or 15.
Of course.
And I didn't really know what art was, because I grew up in the suburbs of Leicester. And, uh-huh. You know, my experience of art was, I don't know, album covers,
yeah,
maybe, because I'd never actually been to an art gallery. So I thought that, like, Adam and the Ants album covers were art.
Yeah.
I've revised that opinion.
You were nominated for the Turner Prize in 2013, and your installation, it was in Londonderry in Northern Ireland, the exhibition.
Derry, Londonderry, so good then.
Derry, Londonderry, sorry. Your installation was...
life model.
A life model, but this kind of sculpture that you'd actually created that even had moving eyelids and everything. And it peed into a bucket, thinking of Marcel Duchamp's urinal. He actually occasionally sporadically peed. And then you invited the audience, the public, to come in and actually draw, like a life drawing class. And that kind of completed the work in a way. Rather than being, I heard you describe it as being exhibitions often propose or offer propositions or, you know, for thought or whatever, but you were actually doing an invitation, which was kind of the point of the whole show. But I was actually weirdly thinking about Duchamp when I was watching that video of that show.
Yeah, it's a funny one. I guess the Turner Prize is a bit of a burden for a lot of artists. It's what goes around comes around kind of thing eventually. And
what do you mean?
Well, the Turner Prize is offered to British artists, or it was offered to British artists under the age of 50. And if you're choosing four a year, every year, you know, the pool, you know, you eventually start...
I see what you're saying, right.
You eventually start scraping the barrel. And that's how I came to be nominated.
What was your show they'd seen, most people had seen?
I did a retrospective at the Hayward Gallery.
Right.
Called Brain Activity. Title I thought of in yoga class.
Oh, you a big yoga man?
I am, yes.
In Brighton?
I haven't found the right class in Brighton, but I had a great teacher in Glasgow called Jerry Keelty, who's it turns out is a very well-respected yoga teacher, you know, in the whole of the UK, mm-hmm. if not elsewhere as well. But I've never found anybody quite as good as him in Brighton, so I'm
maybe still... after talk art you're going to get some messages.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets, featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Arts, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, yeah, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also given people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and Talk Art with Sir Peter Blake.
Okay, can we actually
carry on.
No, can I just segue on something a minute? This is quite fascinating. The idea, even just talking to you, you're a very calm, kind of well-balanced human being, it appears. And you do yoga, and you seem very sort of like
Zen
and good with yourself.
Yeah.
But your work has this element of like the kind of deepest depths of all of our minds, things that we don't necessarily ever verbalise, but you...
Love, death, sex.
Write it all down. And a lot of it just makes me laugh because it's so like, oh my God, I think that, but I would never say it.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that come into be? Is art like therapy for you or something? Or
Yeah, I think it has to be therapy. I think whenever I'm talking about my work, I've become aware that I've been talking about it for 25 years.
Sure. Mm.
And I've been doing it for longer than that. Mm. Like I've been a professional artist for almost that amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been doing nothing else, and that's almost half of my life, mm-hmm. and the great, you know, most of my adult life. So I have lost a bit of perspective on it. So when people say, you're really kind of normal in real life and your work's really mad, I'm just sort of like, I actually think the opposite in a way. I think my work is kind of normal. I think I'm mad. But I think that's because you live inside your own head. You don't. Mm-hmm. The work that I make is, you know, it's a, whilst I love making it and I'm, you know, unhappy when I can't make it, and it is very healthy to make, you know, I sort of see it as, you know, a privilege to make it. And I also, I see it as, I think that everybody should make art. And I think the people that don't are the ones that maybe are missing out on something on a therapeutic level. Mm. Not that everybody needs to make visual art. You can do something else, but I think everybody has to make something. Mm. And I'm just lucky to make that. But in terms of the content, I don't know. Why not? Who, you know, that's just, you just say anything. The great thing about being an artist is that when you're in your studio, you can say whatever you like just to amuse yourself. Mm-hmm. And it's fine. And also, you know, it's like being a rock musician and being rewarded for your bad behaviour.
Yeah.
You know, I am rewarded for it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know.
So when you said you lost perspective, when you had your retrospective at the Hayward, what was that like then, seeing all work that you might have not seen for years come back together?
Everybody, I think all artists are resistant to a retrospective. So I was resistant. I dragged my heels about doing it. But in conversation with a curator, you sort of end up with some kind of compromise whereby there's a retrospective element. But most artists don't want to have a retrospective. Most artists just want to make whatever they're making right now.
Right.
And for the Hayward Gallery to spend a lot of money helping you make it.
Right, right, right. But do you feel like it puts you, sends you backwards then? Do you think it puts your brain activity?
Well, I mean, in terms of what you do, do you want to constantly revisit the things you've done before? The things that you're excited about doing...
Is the next job.
Is the next job, exactly, or the job that you're right in the middle of. Mm-hmm. And even that one you're probably tired of. Mm-hmm. It's the one that's next. It's whatever you're writing or whatever you're going to
keep it
interpret.
Moving. Yeah.
And I think it's the same... I'd imagine it's the same for everybody, where I'm just like, I don't know, I just want to make the next thing. And that's really, and I think it will always be like that. And I think, yeah, in retrospective, okay, you just do the retrospective. Mm-hmm. And I'll just have a look at it.
Turn up opening night.
Send me a list.
Yes.
I'll just put ticks and crosses.
When you were part of the hang, no? The install?
I was. I mean, it was a big deal.
I spent
a lot of time designing the exhibition and trying to find ways of putting it together. Uh-huh. But yeah, there are certain compromises you have to make because of the space and because of things that the curator's vision kind of thing. But that said, I, you know, had a good relationship with the curator. He was really great, and it was a great thing to do. And also, people were quite surprised that I was doing a retrospective at the Hayward.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, I had the conversation whereby people were like, "They're like, what you got coming up?" And I'm like, "Oh, I'm doing an exhibition in London." Oh, right, is it Stephen Friedman? No, it's actually at the Hayward Gallery. And they were like, what? At the Hayward Gallery?
Well, like on tour, like now, you're supported by? No.
And then they were sort of like, instead of saying, oh, well done, that's great, they'd say, oh, well done, cool, that's great. As if they were like, what's up with the Hayward Gallery?
Right.
I really enjoyed that show because I felt like I discovered loads of sides to your work that I didn't
totally.
Even know about. Because I think the drawing is something that you sort of see, especially these days on Instagram, even though your work's so handmade, you seem to have this incredible feed on Instagram where daily I have like a David Trigley thought in my head, you know, like, which is really genius. But I loved all the taxidermy works, like the Jack Russell holding the sign saying, I'm dead.
Yeah. I mean, that's all pre-Inca, that work. Don't make it.
So now you couldn't touch.
You couldn't, do that. Yeah.
2012, when she arrived, no more taxidermy.
And what about your pet?
It's all gone
what
vegan,
about your pet
work?
Ostrich?
Totally vegan. I don't eat meat anymore.
No, really? I don't eat meat either.
Yeah, totally.
Russell never used to eat pork because they're more intelligent
than dogs.
And then I don't eat octopus
anymore. They recognise you and they like being cuddled.
I could never eat. No pork, no lamb, no beef, no chickens.
No chickens, no. That was the hardest one for me to give up. And then once that's gone, it's gone.
Yeah.
I was blown away though.
I still eat fish, though.
I eat fish.
Oh, do you? Mm. I just can't eat octopus anymore because I've been watching all these videos of how intelligent they are. They're so intelligent.
Yeah.
And they can free themselves from any situation.
Yeah, they're the pigs of the sea.
They're totally beautiful. And it's my favourite emoji in Emoji Land.
And also...
Emoji, isn't it?
Sorry, emoji. I don't know why I always say emoji. Sorry.
Do you know how octopuses mate?
No.
Man octopus, one of his tentacles is his penis.
Really? Hot.
He sticks it into the woman octopus's brain.
What?
He spurts his stuff into her brain.
Wow.
And then his penis slash tentacle falls off and he dies. And then in her brain, the gestation happens.
Wow. But the thing is, women are just more intelligent than men anyway. So that kind of makes
sense.
Imagine
that.
That's
hot.
That
is crazy.
That is actually really hot.
So you procreate and then you die.
So, your bit falls off.
Yeah.
And then you die.
Wow.
Yeah, no, that's intense.
And she's got a really bad headache.
Yeah, she's always what's this migraine?
And you're just...
You've got baby octopus growing in your skull.
Sorry.
Oh, God.
That's tough.
Art practice, quickly. Well, not quickly. But are you quite strict with your hours, studio hours? Are you a 9-to-5 man?
Yes. I have to be. I think... My mantra is when I talk to students, I always say, put the hours in and the work makes itself.
Cute.
So the more time you spend in the studio, the more likelihood there is that you'll make something that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And are you a coffee man, tea man?
Two coffees in the morning.
All right.
Then white tea in the afternoon, then peppermint tea. After 4.
Well, you've got a whole routine.
White tea is in herbal white tea or white tea is in milky tea?
White tea as in green tea, you know.
But white.
But the.
And your mantra for life that I read somewhere was like, be nice and work hard. And I was just like, I love that because that is...
So simple, but it's true.
It's also the key to happiness, probably.
I got given advice once by someone that was... I said, what's the key to like success? And they said, just be brilliant. Like, oh, okay. Yeah, just be brilliant. Like, it's an easy thing. Like, just be brilliant. Oh, okay, yeah.
Was that an actor?
Yes. It was James Corden. Yes.
Oh, just be brilliant.
Is it just be brilliant? Oh, okay, yeah. Oh, yeah, fair enough. Great.
Yeah. I genuinely think being nice to people and working hard is a route to success. Because let's face it, if you don't do that...
Yeah.
If you're just lazy and horrible.
But some people slip through the net.
Yeah, they do.
We made a print, Be Nice, with the rainbow.
Be nice.
And look how successful that was.
I didn't tell you. Somebody ripped that off.
I told you that. I sent you the email.
All right, look at that.
It was like a legal case because I was like, get your lawyers on this.
Anyway, we got the lawyers on it and it's all sorted out.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Yeah, in America, basically, this brand, it's like a big Home Depot kind of store thing. They were selling a sort of knockoff version of Be Nice as a little print in a frame, and it was made in China or something. And I was just, one of our customers sent me a picture of it, and I was so appalled, I forwarded it on to David. And he was like, this will be taken care of. It was a very minimal email response, but I was happy that he let me know that it would be taken care of.
Yeah.
Well, what happened?
The guys in a big... black SUV turned up outside the
with
store
guns.
With baseball bats. And they went, they want to speak to the manager.
Yeah.
You'll come here into the van.
Oh my God.
And then it was all sorted out.
Fantastic.
Okay, well, that's good.
Yeah, all above board.
That's often the way to... Yeah, exactly. So one part of your work, which I think is really interesting, is the amount of books you've made. You've made about 40 books, which is way more than most artists make.
You started off being self-published. That was kind of your route into the art world, right?
Yes.
So what is it about the format of the book that you like so much?
Well, when I left art school, I decided to become a cartoonist, even though I had no real understanding of the craft of the cartoonist and what that entailed and how you could make a living from it.
Mm.
But I thought that this was 1991, and I thought, so I started making these, I'd always made drawings and always made them in a sketchbook, and they really weren't for any purpose other than to amuse my friends a lot of the time. So when I was at art school, I knew that my friends looked through my sketchbook when I wasn't there, so I'd make drawings of them.
Oh, how funny.
But did they know that you...
doing unpleasant things.
But did they know that you knew that in the end?
They did eventually, yes. Hilarious. But it was just, you know...
It's like reading your diary and you going, this person's a complete twat.
Knowing that they're going to read it.
Yeah. Anyway, so that I'd always made these drawings, and then I decided when I left art school that I needed to have a career. And I didn't think that one could have a career as a fine artist because, you know, this was pre-YBAs, I guess. So there wasn't really a precedent for that happening to a 22-year-old. So I thought, I'll be a cartoonist and I'll be published in, I don't know, Private Eye or something like that. So I eventually made these books, which were a marketing tool, essentially. The first book was called Slug Trails, and it was published by a small imprint in Glasgow who published two other ventures, which were one of which was a Mark Boland fanzine, and the other one was this very esoteric, satanic writer called Austin Osman Spare. And so it was that, Austin Osman Spare,
and you.
Mark Boland fanzine, and me.
That was the roster.
And I did two books that were published by them. The second one was called Merry Eczema. And then the third one was published, was self-published, 100 copies with a hand-drawn cover. And it was called... can't remember what it was called, actually.
Okay.
Need to look at the archive.
Up parenthesis, yeah.
No, that's the real archive.
Oh, that's the real archive.
That's the real archive.
Oh, yes, of course, sorry.
So that, and then I sort of suddenly realised that the book was a form that was really accessible and interesting, and, you know, I didn't have to conform to anything if I was publishing it myself, and that, you know, it could pay for itself, basically. So the first books were sold for a few pounds, and I sold them in the pub or at art openings or things like that, and people just... I guess they just bought them to make me go away, kind of thing, because it was the same price as a pint of beer.
Right.
And then, you know, stuff happened. People saw them and somebody else started publishing them. And many years later, I'm...
Giant sculptures in Trafalgar Square.
Yeah. And books. But do you follow cartoons? Like, do you like Modern Toss, and do you like The Far Show and Peanuts? Are any of these kind of... columns that you follow?
I like Modern Toss, for example.
Yeah.
I think that's really fun, and you know, I buy those greetings cards send to my brother-in-law. But I'd sort of have come to like cartoons as a result of being a cartoonist rather than, you know, vice versa.
Yeah.
Which is an odd way around. The things that I was always really influenced by, you know, apart from what we've spoken about in terms of fine art, I'm really influenced by writers more than probably as much as fine art, in the sense that I loved, you know, I love Ernest Hemingway.
Right, of course. And Old Man the Sea.
And many, you know, all the writers that you like and lots of other odds and...
So you're a big reader?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say I'm a voracious reader, but I have been a reader for my entire life, and I'm a bit of a snobby reader as well.
In what way?
Ooh, I like that.
In the sense that I can't read bad prose.
Okay.
I mean, I can read it.
Yeah. You have the ability to read it, but you don't
just
want
become
to.
Become dyslexic when I start reading Carl Hyacin or something.
Yeah, yeah. You know? Okay, got it.
But I just don't like it. I don't like bad prose, and I can't read beach books. I just
Danielle Steele or anything doesn't.
Well, the closest I get to pulp,
go on,
is probably, I don't know, Paul Auster or something.
Okay,
Jonathan Franzen or something.
Right,
like
right,
that,
right.
You know, which is middle brow literature, I suppose. But anything less than middle brow is sort of unacceptable, which means that I'm a bit of a snob.
And what about poetry?
You like song lyrics, don't you? You're a big muso, right?
I do. Yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't say I was a big consumer of poetry. I mean, I had to study T.S. Eliot when I did my A level.
Yeah, we all did.
But I don't know. I think there's a time for poetry, but I guess I would rather read, I don't know, Cormac McCarthy.
Got it. Yeah. The Road.
Whatever it is.
What is your newspaper?
What newspaper do I read?
Yeah.
I used to read The Guardian, but I've sort of gone off it.
Have you?
Yeah. I'm just fed up with their constant begging for money.
Right.
And basically anything they give you for free in Waitrose isn't worth having.
Got it.
You know what
good.
I mean?
That's a good moral to live by.
The coffee is rubbish.
Do you get free coffee in Waitrose?
Yeah.
When? Well, how?
Waitrose
you get... They get, you've got your Waitrose card.
Right.
You go in, you can have a cup of coffee in a single-use thermal cup.
And you walk, and you can walk around and shop with that, or...?
Yeah, they give you... Well, I keep the thermal cup.
Oh.
And I take it home with me.
And archive it?
No. For when I need a thermal cup to make coffee, and then I get in a car and have to go somewhere, and then I've got the... Anyway,
yes,
I digress.
No, you don't.
So I don't read. I don't read The Guardian
because
anymore.
Because of the shit coffee in Waitrose. Got
well,
it.
Because it, I don't know. I just think there's so much. It's sort of, in a way, a golden age for media.
Yeah.
In a way, and it's a golden age for music and everything that you consume culturally, because it's all there on the internet. Mm. It's like you can. There's so many interesting online sources to find out about things. So many different viewpoints about things. So I end up would rather read long form essays about, you know, the dark money into Brexit in democracy than I would just read about the same thing in The Guardian. Where I don't know, just give it a cursory glance, and I think there's so much opportunity if you spend a bit of time to be really far more nourished than just reading one newspaper. And I never read the newspaper. The part of the reason we get it, apart from fact that it's free in Waitrose, we get it and then we don't read it and we just use it to put the dog's food on.
Got it.
So we've all just got some newspaper. And that's an indictment against
the Yeah.
So recently you were the curator of the Brighton Festival.
I was.
And for that you had an alt-rock band performance and you actually wrote songs, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
And what is your relationship to music? Because I see that you've like made music videos for Blur and different bands and you've even designed like album covers for people. So do you have a strong relationship with music yourself?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I've always been my main passions in life are music, art and football.
We can't talk to you about football.
Oh, no, but you actually designed a mascot, didn't you, for a football team? Didn't
yes,
you design a mascot?
Yes.
A kind of crazy yellow
Yeah, I did.
Mascot?
Oh, yeah, I remember that. What was that team?
Partick Thistle. The Jags.
And it was kind of controversial. People didn't really understand what it was, right? What was this creature?
Well, very briefly... I met somebody who ran a hedge fund in California, and after dinner conversation, they ended up sponsoring my local team in Glasgow.
Wow!
And then on the understanding that I would do all the artwork and design a mascot that was based on their company logo, which was a rising sun. So I made this thing called Kingsley, and who looked a bit like a version of Lisa Simpson.
Yeah.
A weird, angry
quite
version.
Haunting, yeah. Wasn't it? Yeah.
And it's and to my great pride, it's been Scottish Football Association mascot of the year 3 years running.
Now that is a prize.
Where is
want.
It stored when it's not?
Well, there are two of it. My friend Susie Hunter, who I was at art school with, Susie does contour sculpture. She's made two versions of it because it gets a bit grubby.
Got it, yeah.
With the wings touching him.
And it's bright yellow, isn't it?
Right. And he sort of he celebrates with the team. He does the minute silence before the game. That's always
amazing. I can't wait to put that on the Instagram feed. That's going to be one that people are going to love to
so
see.
So going back to music, so how did it come about working with Blur or all of that?
Well, yeah, what goes around comes around. I suppose it's a bit like a Turner Prize. You end up.
Things just
if you do animation.
Everyone works with Blur in the end.
Yeah. No, I mean, if you do animation, eventually you're going to do a pop promo. And that was quite a long time ago, maybe 2003. Mm. And you still got paid in those days, paid proper money to do. So I did it in collaboration with some guys called Shinola in London. And we did this thing and it sort of went really well and we won an award for it and stuff. But... I used to be in a band. We were rubbish, basically. And I always had a problem with the problem. I ended up being the songwriter in the band and the singer. And I can't really, I mean, I'm not a very good singer or a very good musician, and I'm not a very good songwriter. So what I found was I could only ever write three chords, and I could never write the chorus. So I thought for this Brighton Festival project, I made all these guitars, which are sort of a sculptural thing in a way, but they're all guitars with like one string or strings and frets in the wrong place and stuff. So they work, but they're all weird electric guitars. Anyway, you can see pictures on my website and on Instagram and whatnot. But we decided to make this performance where I write a lot of lyrics, I write a lot of stuff. So I'd written all these lyrics, and then I met one of my first friends in Brighton was a guy called Lee Baker, who lives up the road from me. And we did a couple of projects together. And then I sort of said, oh, would you write the music if I sort of tell you what I want and give you some examples? Because he's a guy who writes for TV and for... and he's basically just a really brilliant at synthesizing various genres. Mm-hmm. And so really understands the way that music goes together. So I said, if I just tell you, if I say I want it to sound like Led Zeppelin meets, I don't know, Nirvana's...
S Club 7.
Nirvana's first album, etc. Can you do that? He's like, yeah, I can do that. So anyway, he did it. And then it just sort of wasn't quite right. And he's like, right, why don't... I was in the studio one day, and I just started playing his guitar, and he's like, you can play the guitar. And I was like, well, after a fashion. And he's like, right, you write the songs.
Oh,
and
wow.
Then you just write them and sing them. And I'm like, but I can't do the chorus. He's like, that's fine, I'll do the chorus. You do the three chords.
A proper collaboration.
So that's what we did. It was like, E, E, A, A, E, G. and then he comes in with like a major, whatever it is, or a minor something. And I'm like, wow, it works. But then, unfortunately, he kept all the recordings that I'd made.
Oh.
And then started playing them. just singing into the computer.
But have they been recorded officially?
Yeah, we did. We made them. No, the terrible thing was that we didn't record them. We performed them, and it went quite well. It wasn't...
And that's on YouTube, or...?
I don't know how you mention it. Bits of it are here and there, but... Yeah, unfortunately, we didn't record it, and we sort of can't really go back to it at this stage for reasons I won't go into. But it sort of, yeah, it was like maybe 65% finished. Mm-hmm. So it was a work in progress. We had a certain amount of time and a certain amount of resources to fill, and we sort of did it. And then we were going to go back to it, and then we haven't been able to do that. But it ended up working really well. I didn't perform in it.
You didn't in the end?
I was just the director.
You did that, right.
Which was really good fun.
Was it nice watching that all come to life, though?
Well, what was great was we were in the rehearsal studio, and I'd be like, no, take, you just bang on the big drum. What's that called? The bass tom-tom. Yeah, bang on that one. And then yeah, hit that one. No, not that cymbal. Oh, the ride cymbal. What's it called? Yeah, that one. And then the bass drops out. And then comes back in again, and it was so much fun.
So you're like rock opera conductor.
Totally. But I just, a slightly moronic version of that, where I just didn't know the names of...
I love that.
...any of the sort of...
Instruments.
...nomenclature of...
Something I heard about this whole project was that you were waking up in the middle of the night with song lyric ideas or melody ideas, and then you'd record it in your voice notes on your phone. And that is something, when I was a singer-songwriter, would be like, I did all the time. But I used to have like a Tascam four-track recorder, and then when you got the iPhone or whatever
it
was...
Did it work for you?
It used to work for me all the time, and I'd wake up in the morning and I'd be like, thank God I did it. But you were like, when you woke up in the morning, it sounded like someone very sleepy and a bit, and who couldn't sing.
It sounded like somebody mumbling. And then there's the sound of my wife in the background going, what's wrong with you? What are you doing?
I also loved this idea that you'd go on aeroplanes, and because you were so captive, that would sort of free up your creativity. Because I wrote all my songs for my first album when I was flying. We used to do gigs in America, and I would just constantly write when I was on flights. And the minute I came off a flight, I wouldn't be able to write anymore.
Wow.
There's something about the activation that happens creatively when you're on an aeroplane.
Totally. I just went to Australia and New Zealand, got so much done. It's like I got 2 weeks' work done in 2 days.
I know, I think they should descend all creative people on aeroplanes.
Do you always carry a sketchbook around with you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah or no? Yeah.
Yeah, no, I've got it. It's in there.
It's in there.
Yeah.
And are you someone that's like, you'd be sat on the train now on the way home and you'd be sketching?
I might be sketching, or I might... a lot of the time it's notes of things where I'm like, I don't know, make notes.
And what comes first? Because a lot of your work is written and there's an image. Is it the image or the writing?
Probably writing comes first, and then I make an image, and then sometimes I go back to the writing, or sometimes something different comes.
Got it, great.
So it's a bit like that. What was the name of your band?
Tempo Shark.
Tempo Shark.
And funnily enough, since we've been doing this podcast, my royalties have gone up.
Really?
Yeah, because Russell mentioned the band in the first episode.
But the music credit, the music beginning of this is your music.
The music on Talk Art at the beginning and the end, which somebody, a reviewer recently described as a B-movie soundtrack. I was a bit like, oh, thanks for that. Yep. That's actually from Tempo Shark. It was a song called Joy. So, but bizarrely, we're getting way more PRS than I used to get. Well, I guess the other guys are too, who wrote the songs. I'm getting more PRS. Right. But anyway, it's a funny phenomenon that these days, if you make something 10 years ago, it's still out there existing.
Your music's on the Kardashians as well.
It's on all kinds of things, yeah.
Music's in the background.
The first,
music, the Kardashians.
Five seasons of the Kardashians TV show, they took a lot of my vocals out, but you sometimes hear the backing vocals, and his ex-boyfriend Dan used to text me going like, I'm watching Kim Kardashian, and it's your song on the back. And then he got really into my band because of it. It was hilarious.
Through
at the time, I didn't even know
imagine
who they were.
Discovering your music through the Kardashians.
They weren't famous back then, though. And then they've become so famous that we get PRS all the time from it.
But they've dropped you for the new series.
Yeah, I don't think I'm on the... I think I'm on the first sort of four or five seasons or something like that. It's very funny.
Who have they got now, Kanye?
But can I say something? I stopped writing music when I became a gallerist and I, you know, changed my life, all that stuff. But it has come back to me every so often. So when my dad died, I wrote songs. But weirdly, watching your Tate video where you're inviting people to come in and do life drawing and you were kind of encouraging people's creativity, it has sort of made me think, oh, I should, you know, open up that side to myself that I think I shut off. And I'm going to put a piano in my house in Margate, I've decided. So I might make a record one day.
Yeah, you do periodically say to me, I'm going to make some more music.
I do still write sometimes, but only for myself. And the idea of putting it out in the world kind of terrifies me. But I think I'm actually going to consciously do it as like a hobby again and write
MIDI
songs.
MIDI keyboard. Yeah. What's that one where you have like the pen, it goes...
That's a stylophone.
Stylophone. I love those.
Yeah.
I love real pianos, actually.
If you was an instrument, you'd be a stylophone.
I was having my photograph taken a while ago. By this guy, and he said, oh, I just went to photograph John Terry, footballer, yeah, who played for Chelsea at the time. He said, oh, what's his house like? He said, oh, he's got a white grand piano on the mezzanine floor.
Oh, my word.
I said, does he play the piano? He said, no. But there's always, like you, maybe he put it there and he's thinking, well, I just, you know.
One day.
Anybody. You know, that guy, David Shrigley, if he can get in people to be creative, I could do that once my career's over.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So he's just retired, John Terry.
Well, we look out for that concert.
Well, let's send out positive vibes to everyone listening today.
And
if
John
you
Terry.
Have any inkling within your bones that you want to be creative, just do it. And I also find, like you were saying, if you read, that's when creative ideas often come.
Yeah.
And I actually stopped myself reading for years because I was so like over being creative. And that was, I find reading so in sort of lights the fire or something.
Read lots and then go on a very long plane journey.
Yeah. That's our advice.
Very good advice.
So, David Shrigley, thank you so much.
No, we've got to ask questions. We always ask all our guests. What's your favourite colour?
Red.
Why?
I just really like it.
Fantastic. And if you was going to do an art heist,
if you were going to steal a painting from a museum, or what's a touchstone for you? What would you like to take home?
I'd have a Philip Guston.
Oh, yes. Amazing.
Our sleeve art for Talk Art is actually based on a Philip Guston painting of us looking up.
Cool.
Mm. What Philip Guston one especially?
Well, probably not one of the ones with the Ku Klux Klan's.
No, too much.
Maybe just one of the one of him in bed, or the character in bed smoking.
Yes.
One of those ones.
Do you know an artist called Armin Elowen, who's very heavily inspired by him?
I don't think
Timothy
so.
Taylor Gallery. But his work was inspired by Guston, and his work is like that. But yeah, that's a great response.
And
I was just in
Germany with the Belgian artist Nell Arts, and she is definitely following on from that tradition. She's amazing.
Yeah.
You'd love her, actually, because she makes books and films and crazy kind of surreal performances. She's really cool.
Do you live with your own work?
No.
Do you collect work?
Yes.
What do you collect?
Tend to buy things by younger artists who I feel like it sort of supports them doing something.
Emerging.
Yes. I've got a few.
What have you got?
What, names?
Yeah, well, people that people would like to know about.
One or two things that I've bought from people over the years where the person's sort of become better known. Do you know a painter called Celia Hempton.
Yes. Yeah,
of course.
I've made prints with her. I love
her. The partner
She's
of Eddie
really
Peake. They're a couple, aren't they? Yeah.
Well, when Celia was at art school, they left. They used to live in Glasgow, and me and Kim bought some of her work.
Because, Kim's your wife.
Yeah,
yeah.
Just because they needed some money, basically.
She's great. Down.
So
really,
anyway,
really
we've
like
got these beautiful paintings. I mean,
are they genitals?
No, she used to go to scrap yards and places like that and paint al fresco. Mm. I think she still does.
She does, yeah.
Yeah, but they're just small landscapey type pictures.
Oh, nice. I really like those, that series by her.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
But yeah, anyway, I'm really glad she's doing well. Mm. But, in a way, it's sort of a burden to have things that are valuable.
Yeah,
but
true.
I've got.
We were going to get them on this because we were going to do like art couples because they're like both working a couple.
I know, but it's kind of problematic that I think it's a bit. I don't know, but yeah.
Yeah, I don't think they really
don't know
wanted
if they're
to
do that. Or not. I'd love to interview both of them. I think they're great, Eddie and her.
No, they'd start having an argument, probably.
But that'd be amazing.
That'd be audio gold.
That'd be a great podcast.
That's not the way it works.
Oh,
you'd feel really bad.
Would we?
I don't know.
We want to get control.
We wouldn't join in. We wouldn't choose sides.
I feel bad for suggesting it.
We'd just facilitate it. Yeah.
Well, David Shigley.
We'd conduit it. There we go.
The conduit.
Woo. Thank you so much.
Thank
for
you so much.
On.
What a pleasure to meet you. So hang on. So what's your website?
My website.
Yes.
www.davidshrigley.com.
Amazing. And you're on Instagram?
Yes.
At
David Shrigley.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Strangely enough.
And I actually really love the headline on your website, like the bit that comes up at the top of the website. It says, David Shrigley, artist, 197 centimetres tall.
It's and that's like tall. You
factual.
Are tall. Because you're sat down and you're
still
tall.
You are so tall.
What are you, 16 foot?
I'm 6'5 in old money, but I'm very long in the body.
You are.
Which is just like your life model and your thumbs up. They're always elongating.
Oh, yeah, really,
your
really good. The fourth plinth. That was incredible. What was that experience like?
Really good.
It was really good.
But why was it so elongated? It's just so mental.
Because as I said to Vanessa Phelps when she interviewed me on her radio program.
Love
Phelps
her.
Or Feltz?
Feltz.
Feltz. Just
Feltz.
Just,
Feltz.
Yeah.
What, how do you say it?
Feltz.
Feltz.
F-E-L-T-Z.
F-E-L-T-Z.
You're saying Phelps.
Yes, her.
Yep. Phelps. Yeah, go on.
Phelps.
Who's Phelps. It? You're thinking of Michael Phelps.
Fuzzy Phelps.
Yes, okay. Fuzzy Phelps. Yeah. Yeah, go on.
Where are we going with this?
Really, really long thumb. Why was it really long?
Anyway, I had to speak to her on the morning of the unveiling, and it was at like 7 o'clock in the morning. It was difficult. Anyway, she wasn't having any of it. But what I said was, it's not just good, because if it's good, it's just a thumb up. It's really good because, you know, the signifier in the gesture is the thumb, is it not?
Yes.
So if you make the thumb bigger, then that increases the
how
level
good of goodness.
How good it is. So it's really good, obviously.
Yeah.
Do I have to explain
and she,
that?
But she wasn't happy with that.
She was. She made a noise like kind of... as if to say, what a lot of nonsense.
I have a way to tie up this.
Even said that.
I have a way to tie up this fantastic interview. So we made a print with you around that time for the Rio Olympics that was the thumbs up image.
Yes.
With the slogan or mantra, life is fantastic.
Yes.
So I want everyone.
That was your biggest seller, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. I want everyone listening to this podcast to remember that life is fantastic. There is hope.
There is.
And be creative. David Shrigley, thank you so much for
joining
Shriggers.
Us.
Everybody listening, you can visit our Instagram at TalkArt to see images of everything we've spoken about today. And we will be back very soon.
Back soon. Big laugh. Thank
Bye,
you.
Bye, David.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to TalkArt with Robert Diamant and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at TalkArt, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Recorded at Spiritland London by Anthony Shaw and edited by Gareth Isles. Subscribe to Talk Art on iTunes and Spotify. Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real, frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.